Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 184 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. We have a great guest lined up for you today, but before we dive into his amazing story and everything that he has to share about Magic, I do want to say thank you to the patrons. You mean the world to the show. Because of you, we have things rocking and rolling, and it's just amazing to have such awesome supporters of the show. Of course, each and every month, I love doing a giveaway as a give back to the patrons, and if you're interested in being involved in that, you can go to mtgprotutor.com/Patreon to learn more about that. I do also want to give a huge shout out to my friend Sam over at Kitchen Table Magic. He invited me to be a guest on his podcast, and I'm so grateful. It's always fun to connect with other content creators and learn and share and grow, and it's kind of fun to be on the other side of the table for one. So he interviewed me on his show, Kitchen Table Magic. The episode came out today, actually. We have concurrent release days, so Kitchen Table Magic, check out that podcast. Today's episode is yours truly, and it was a lot of fun. It was really cool to chat with him and like I said, be on the other side for once, so that was fun. And I also want to announce the release of the Deck Building Masterclass this Friday. All the videos are done being recorded. I just had to go through and do some minor editing. We have like 4 hours of content with amazing pros talking about how to analyze the meta, how to track the shifts from week to week, why those shifts are made, and then what to do next, what considerations to think of when you're going to make a deck. And it was just really awesome to get these three pros' perspectives and really dive deep into the deck building process. Obviously, the cards that we look at are Aether Revolt standard, but the process is evergreen. So you'll be able to analyze any meta moving forward, have the tools that you need to think critically about each card decision, why it's there, what it's doing. Consider if you take out a card because of XYZ reason, what does that open you up to? And then what do you need to fill in that hole? There's just some really good discussions, and I'm really looking forward to share it with you. Basically, what's going to happen is, as I mentioned, I'm just doing some minor editing on the videos. I'm going to make a nice, actionable download, like a PDF that everybody will have access to. You can kind of get the top-level stuff, the synopsis of everything that we talked about in this quick, crunchy PDF. And then there'll be an option for those who are interested to dive into the videos and access those and really get to hear what AJ, Michael, and Matt have to say. So that's coming out this Friday. And if you're interested in being instantly notified as soon as the masterclass is available, you can go to deckbuildingmasterclass.com and sign up for the waiting list there. Again, you're not going to be waiting that long because here we are on Tuesday and the Deck Building Masterclass comes out on Friday. But all the same, deckbuildingmasterclass.com is where you can go to get on the waiting list and be instantly notified as soon as the masterclass goes live on Friday. I'm super pumped. I loved how this came together. Last week was so much fun recording with these great players. Again, it was AJ Soccer, Michael Majors, Matt Severa. Between the three of them, they have an amazing record and just a very deep understanding of standard and how to evaluate the meta and how to make decks and move forward. So good stuff. A lot of good stuff. Can't wait to share it with you this Friday. Deckbuildingmasterclass.com is where you can go for that. Well, that's it for the top of the interview stuff. We have a great guest, like I said. Can't wait to bring him in. So without further ado, let's do that now. Sit down and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I am super excited to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a Toronto native, known locally for his dedication to the game and aggressive hyperbole. He had a breakout year in 2014, top 80 Grand Prix Montreal after going undefeated in the Swiss rounds. Then he represented Canada at the World Magic Cup. Since then, he's rattled off another pair of Grand Prix top 8s and is hoping to make it big on the Pro Tour stage. Coming to us from Toronto, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Daniel Fournier. Daniel, how are you doing today?
Hey, not bad. Glad to be here.
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
I was born ready.
Excellent. We love that. Now, prodigies out there, if you want to connect with Daniel, you can do so on Twitter. He's at TIRENTU, T-I-R-E-N-T-U. So you can reach out to him there, say thanks for being on the show, ask him a question. But that is how you can find him on the internet. So, Daniel, we mentioned that you are from Toronto. Are you born and raised in there? You've been there your whole life?
Yeah, more or less. I spent a few years out in Halifax, East Coast represent for school, but I've been in Toronto most of my life.
Awesome. What did you go to school for?
I went to school for a bunch of different things that I never fully completed, but I have a I have a bunch of years in like international relations, history of science and technology, arts degrees.
Well, that's really neat. That's cool that you've you know, studied different things and have a wide breadth of, you know, experience in different areas. And that's really fun that you've were able to spend some time to kind of get out there and, you know, take formal classes on lots of things that interest you.
It was a good time all in all, although I mostly played Magic. I'm not going to lie to you.
Well, good for you, man. I mean, as far as the content of this show goes, that's good for us, I guess.
Significantly more important.
Love it. So we would love to hear your origin story. You know, take us back to the day. Tell us the very first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards.
So much to my dad's chagrin, actually, he bought me the Portal starter set, the original Portal starter set, when I was like 5 or 6 or something. He wanted to play a game with me. He's like, Magic the Gathering, that looks sweet. And he bought it, tried to get me to play, and I had absolutely no interest because I was a tiny child. I'm like, this is stupid, I don't understand, I hate this. So that was awkward.
Sounds about right. Yeah.
And then like 6 or 7 years later or so, I'm in, I guess, middle school, whatever, at this point. And my friends have started picking up this game called Magic the Gathering. I'm like, whoa, what's this? This was like shortly, like around the release of Onslaught. And so I built a black-white cleric tribal deck.
Oh, nice.
Where we had a lot of house rules, and we didn't really understand how the game worked, but we played at lunchtime and stuff. For instance, we thought that there was some cleric that said a black, sacrifice a creature, like drain them for 2 or something, and we thought that you could sacrifice your opponent's creatures, so that card was like completely busted.
Yeah,
we had like house rules like at the end of your turn, if you have no cards in hand, draw 7.
Good stuff.
So yeah, stuff like that. Yeah.
It's always fun hearing like the early, you know, stories when people didn't know what the heck was going on. Yeah, it's just crazy. Like lands were one-time uses, I've heard. You know, you tap them and they go away. And it's like, what? And their games lasted forever. Dark Ritual would stay on the battlefield and tap for 3 every turn. Like, I've heard crazy, stuff that people did back in the day. And not that like, oh, I was so good. I try and think of what I did, because I came in, you know, when I was 12 or whatever, during Tempest and Stronghold and all that. But I think just whoever taught me, my friend, had a good grasp of the rules or something, because I don't have like those crazy, ridiculous, I mean, we probably were doing stuff wrong, but nothing so obscure like lands tapping for wrong stuff or whatever. So, but I always love hearing people's early stories.
We didn't really know what was going on, but kind of just loved it anyways. To be fair, in our and other people's defense, a lot of Magic cards kind of don't make sense unless you're like understanding of the mechanics of the game. Like, I've worked at card shops for the past few years, and it's practically impossible to explain like Land War Elves or Elvish Mystic to a new player. Tap, add green to your mana pool. Well, what does that mean? You get a forest from your deck? No, it just works like a forest, but it's a creature.
Yep.
Yeah, it works like a forest.
Interesting. But you can't do it the turn that you cast it, like you would do a forest, because he has so many. Yeah. Okay.
It's just like a forest, but not at all.
I love it. And then you have Dryad Arbor, which is just like a creature, God, yeah, but
not. Not even go there.
So you came. Yeah, very first set was Portal. Love it. And anything good, by the way? There's some Portal cards that are worth a lot.
I know that there was a Wrath of God in the booster pack or whatever that came with the starter set. I have no idea where it is. I got lost in the ages.
Was Imperial Recruiter Portal, or is that like?
Yeah, it's P3K.
Yeah, I think so. Cool. So what has been your favorite set?
Probably Cons of Tarkir, just because of how much I enjoyed the limited format. Triple Cons is definitely lit.
Yeah, you like that. Awesome. Before we go too far, I know that we have some listeners that started playing Magic not too long ago, and so when I throw out stuff that I just assume people know, I want to make sure we cover it. So the reason why I asked about Imperial Recruiter, everybody, you prodigies out there, is because it is like, it's basically like a red creature tutor, right? It's like super cheap, you play it out, and it's worth, it's really expensive because it was only in the Portal 3 Kingdoms set, which was forever ago, very limited. And it has a very unique ability in that it gives red the opportunity to go, you know, search for pretty much any creature they want, right? And put it on the battlefield or in your hand, something like that. It's busted. And so that's why I asked. So anyway,
it's relevant in a legacy deck, because it could go get a card called Painter Servant for a combo with Grindstone.
There it is. And Painter Servant turns every card in your opponent's deck, whether it's in their hand, library, or wherever, a certain color. And then you can just do shenanigans off of that. So.
Yeah.
Good. So, and they just made the Painter Servant into a masterpiece. What, last set? Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Both of these cards have reprints recently.
Oh.
So. Sorry. I don't know about Grindstone, but okay, yeah, Imperial Recruiter was in Oh no, it wasn't Imperial Recruiter.
I don't think so. I think that was still one of those.
Yeah. I'm confusing it with one of those other Portal Three Kingdoms cards that was in like Commander's Arsenal or something. Yeah. Whatever, it doesn't matter.
Right on. Cool. So back on track. So you like the Khans of Tarkir set because the triple Khans was really fun to draft. Along the same lines, what is one of your favorite cards?
My favorite card, not close, is Vendilion Clique.
Ooh, excellent. So for those of us who don't know, what is that card? What does it do? And why do you like it?
So Clique costs blue 1. It's a legendary fairy wizard. It's a 3/1. It has flash and flying. So you can play it whenever you want. And it says when it comes into play, look at target player's hand. You may choose a card from it, reveal it, and put it on the bottom of that player's library. If they do, they draw a card. So it's kind of like a hand disruption effect, but you don't have to pick something. You can play it whenever you want. You can target yourself to filter your own hand. It's like the sheer number of, it's a 3/1, so like it's actually like relevant in attacking, but it's also fragile, so like you don't just always play it. It's like super interesting, like the sheer number of decisions that come up when playing that card, and that to me is kind of like a good representation of Magic as a whole. It's a game where you have a million decisions, and they're all like super important, and I think that's great.
That's awesome. That's perfect for kind of the next topic is what makes Magic fun for you? Like, why do you like it? Sounds like you're really enamored with the complexity and the decision-making aspect of Magic.
Yeah, I like that it's a game that's like not mechanically complicated, but also still so infinitely complicated that it's practically impossible to play correctly. It's like a puzzle that's constantly changing, but always has a solution. And so trying to find the solution to that puzzle is like, it's great. It's usually the thing that's fun about it is that it's usually an approximation, and because of the time constraints placed on a match of Magic, you can't like get super hung up over yourself for not finding the optimal play every turn because you only have so much time. I think literally nobody has ever played Magic perfectly, and that's awesome.
That is awesome. And I love that quote. It's a puzzle that's constantly changing but always has a solution. So I think that's really cool. I love that. I absolutely love that. So when you started getting serious about Magic, what was an aspect that you struggled with or that you were terrible at, but that you eventually overcame?
I had struggled a lot initially with deck building in that I had literally no idea what I was doing, probably like mostly everybody else. The first tournament I tried to play and actually didn't get to go to because my parents wouldn't let me was a Mirrodin block. Not Mirrodin block, maybe it was Standard in Mirrodin, but it was sometime when Affinity was the biggest thing, and it was like a regionals in Toronto. And I knew I couldn't possibly in a million years afford the cards to build the Affinity deck, like Arcbound Ravagers and all that stuff. It was just way too expensive. And so I tried to build an artifact hate deck. So every card in my deck was a deck that tried to kill artifacts. That obviously at that point I was still a small child and didn't really know what was going on, but it kind of like resonated a bit in all of the decks I chose to play until I started like playing and testing with people who were better than me. I would always like pick an aggro deck that looked strong and then just like play whatever list I saw from the internet. Maybe never really understand the sideboard cards, but always just do it anyways. Just like run whatever someone else says, but never understand why. And being able to understand why the cards are there and changing the cards for how you want to build your deck for your playstyle was kind of like the big change of, oh, I can win tournaments and not go 4-4 in all of them.
Okay. So how do you get to that point? Because lots of Magic players struggle with the same thing that, you know, they want to play and, you know, they want results. And so they figure, well, I'll just go get a deck that works. But a lot of people are stuck on that part right there, which is not understanding why what's in the deck is there. And especially why the sideboard is what it is. Cause that sideboard was made for a certain meta. And if you just copy it and you show up to a tournament a week or two later, it's going to be completely different. You know, the core of the deck could be the same and, you know, necessary and still good or effective, but definitely the sideboard probably needs to be tweaked. So what did you do? And what can we do to really, get to that point?
I got a little bit lucky in terms of the quality of decks that I've been able to play over the years. I have a group of friends in Toronto who I was and do play test with, whatever. We're affectionately known as Team Lucas Seow's Basement, in that the team is kind of captained in a sense by another guy from Toronto named Lucas Seow, who's he's been called by Brian David Marshall at one point as the best constructed mind on the Pro Tour. Not that he's played the Pro Tour in several years because he's working on an MBA in, you know, real life. But basically, yeah, we were called Team Lucas Seow's Basement because we would test and draft in his tiny basement. And he hates it because he doesn't want to be associated with a basement on the internet because, you know. But basically, Lucas is probably one of, if not the best deck builder in the world when it comes to like mid-range standard decks. He's like Jerry T, but like very specifically good at building like black green always. So I had a bunch of tournaments where Lucas had been playing like standard for 4 weeks in a row and just had figured out by the end of it, like, okay, this is exactly the right 75 cards. And then every time we went to a tournament, we would just have like the obvious perfect mid-range deck. Like there would be cards in the sideboard. Like him and Paul Dean, who's another guy in the group and now platinum. So that's cool. Yeah, they showed up to Pro Tour Battle for Zendikar with the world's weirdest Abzan aggro deck. So this was the format with like Anafenza the Foremost, whatever, the 3-mana 4/4 Anafenza, and then like Siege Rhino and Gideon and, you know, good stuff. Good stuff aggro. And so they had this deck that was built just so weirdly. Like there's this card called Abzan Charm that's like one of the reasons why that deck was so good. It costs white, black, green. It's an instant, and it has like 400 modes on it. It has 3 modes. It like pumps your creature, exiles one of theirs, or draws you 2 cards and loses you 2 life, to simplify it. And that card is like so obviously powerful, and it was kind of like the best, like obvious best card in the deck, why Abzan was like such a dominant force for like the 2 years or whatever that card was legal, blah, blah, blah. And they played 3 Abzan Charm main, and then 1 in the sideboard. That was like the level of like weird perfection that like those deck lists had been tuned to, because like he needed like some number of other removal spells and, like the 3 drop slot was clogged up, and it's like, oh my god, it was just unbelievable. And I'm not gonna lie, I never understood Lucas's deck building. He would show up with a deck for a tournament, famously at a GP Toronto 2015 or something. He showed up with an Abzan control list like the Friday night. I'm like, okay, this looks terrible, but you're a genius, so I'll play it. I made it like 4 cards strictly worse. And then at the GP, I lost my quarterfinals match, and he won the tournament. Like, all right. Like, I guess I just don't understand a genius like that. But something important to note from that exact tournament, though, is that I actually changed that deck because I didn't understand what some of the cards were for. There was like a Nissa in the main deck, Nissa Worldwaker, like a powerful planeswalker. He had like a Crux of Fate, like a mass removal spell in the main deck. And I just literally didn't understand what those were there for. So I changed them. And so like, the lesson to be learned from that was, even though I'm pretty sure I made the deck worse because I didn't understand why it was better, it's noted that you shouldn't play cards if you don't know why they're there.
That's a good point too, you know, because then you'll just... they might amount to a dead card because you just don't know when they're supposed to be used, and they just sit in your hand and you never get to use them. So yeah, that's a good point. When was your breakthrough, Daniel?
Well, my first, like, I'm going to call it a lucky breakthrough was definitely like that, like that GP Montreal where I somehow went 13-0 in Swiss in a limited tournament, despite not really knowing what I was doing. And then went to a pro tour and thought I was just the coolest person in the world and didn't really know what was going on. So 1-2 draft immediately, drafting poorly, you know, the usual. But probably the moment where, like, by breakthrough, do you mean like tournament breakthrough or like?
Well, no, like, yeah, when either a period of time or an event that you can look back on and say, wow, like, I can actually do this. Like, I've stepped up, I can play at a higher level, and consistently doing well is not outside of the realm of possibility for me.
All right. That probably also falls into another Lucas CS story. This was somewhere during Theros block standard, where mono black devotion was king. So it was the deck with Pack Rat and Thoughtseize and Hero's Downfall, just like a bunch of very obvious powerful black cards. And Lucas, being Lucas, took this deck and was like, this is too normal, this is too boring, we're going to add another color. Typically what people were doing was adding white for a Blood Baron of Viscopa, which is this big black-white, I think it was a legend, doesn't really matter. But the thing that mattered about it is that it had protection from black and lifelink. So basically it was considered just a hoser to mono-black. So you had the black-white deck that was slightly favored against mono-black, but like worse against other decks, whatever. Lucas was like, screw that, we're playing green. I go, okay. Because Scavenging Ooze, which is like a Legacy and Modern All-Star, was legal and standard, and people weren't really playing it very much because, I don't know, things are confusing. So we rolled up to GP Chicago. This was the first $50 Grand Prix that everybody was super upset about. How dare they charge us $50 for Grand Prix? That's the funny. Good old days. We roll up to GP Chicago with Mono Black Devotion with Scavenging Ooze. So Scavenging Ooze costs like a lot of green mana to make it work. So the deck was a little awkward, but we both scrubbed out of the GP. And then we played the Super Sunday series, the big Sunday side event. We both went undefeated in Swiss because the deck was like unbeatable. I won the tournament, and Lucas, I won the tournament beating Lucas in top four.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, oh, maybe I don't just suck. Maybe this deck's like actually really good and I kind of know what I'm doing with it. And so the next weekend, I flew to GP Washington, D.C., which was like Born of the Gods. No, it was a Journey into Nyx Sealed. I 0-3'd the GP. Was extremely upset and thought, man, you know what? I'm really confident in Standard. I'm going to register for the Sunday Super Series again, even though I can't win it. And then I conceded the finals of the Sunday Super Series again.
What?
So wow. I made it to the finals and scooped. I'm like, oh. Maybe if you build a Standard deck perfectly, alternatively, just listen to Lucas. That's the same thing. and learn to play it well over the course of a season, that is rewarding, and you're just going to win all the time. And then a couple months later, still in the same format, we made a couple changes to the deck at this point because M15 had come out, and we added Nissa World Waker to the main deck. You'll notice a trend of Nissa World Waker popping up in all of these stories. She's my bae. We added Nissa World Waker to the deck, brought it to the World Magic Cup qualifier in Montreal, and then I won that. And I played like three tournaments with that deck and won it. Just like, oh, all right. I guess I can win now. I beat Paul Dean in the finals of that tournament too. So there's some like recurring friend assassination segments in this too.
That's awesome. I really liked when you said, you know, realizing that by building a solid deck and then playing that deck well for an entire season, you know, you can really get to know it very well and you can put up results that will get you places. I think that was really cool and an astute observation. That's awesome. That's really
exactly awesome. And that's the thing that Standard is ultimately like super rewarding for. It's difficult in formats like Modern and Legacy to get an edge by doing that, because you're going to come up against people who have, no matter what deck you're playing, you're going to come up against somebody who's been playing their deck for longer. Everybody's been like, you know, there's always going to be Merfolk guy who's been playing Merfolk for the past 45 years and he's played 2 million matches with the deck, and you're never going to get a familiarity edge on them. But in Standard specifically, and if formats like Block Constructed or Frontier or whatever ever like come back or become a thing, any one of these like smaller card pool formats, people change decks a lot. People change decks like criminally quickly. And frequently to their detriment. People are always looking for the flavor of the week, the hotness. Oh, what did Owen post? I'm going to play that. You are rewarded for picking a deck that is good, building it perfectly to how you understand it, and actually winning with it.
It's so funny that you mentioned Merfolk, because just last episode, we had Jonathan Zacek on, and he's like the Merfolk master. And so we talked a lot about Merfolk. So it's funny that you throw it out there as an example of people who, you know, play a deck and play it a lot and they play it very well. And we have a perfect example of that just last episode. So perfect.
Yeah, he was in the GP finals, right?
Yeah, he lost to Josh Utter-Layton.
Yeah, that guy's okay.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, Merfolk also took down two other Grand Prix, like two of his friends. They won GP Copenhagen in 2015 and then GP LA in 2016 with Merfolk. And so anyway, so it's just funny that you mentioned that one. So cool. Yeah,
that's
I love that because
I don't even consider, I don't actually think Merfolk's like, this is like harsh, but I don't think Merfolk's a good deck. But it's clear that people keep winning with it, and that's just like pure mastery of understanding exactly what all the weird cards are for, and
exactly
just shows.
Yeah,
shows
exactly. And so I love that. So that's a good breakdown, and I appreciate you diving into that. And so as you've gone through Magic, obviously everyone has ups and downs, highs and lows, but those highs and lows are unique to each player. And so we'd love to dive into your worst Magic moment, and what did you learn from that experience?
My actual worst Magic moments. The worst for me was probably right at the beginning of Pro Tour M15. It was my first Pro Tour. I was kind of like nervous. Hadn't really like experienced something quite like that before. I was excited but nervous. And this is in Portland, Oregon. And I had tested for the week beforehand with a bunch of Canadians and some guys from Michigan. We were our team, mtgcanada.com. And we had showed up in Portland for the week. We had tested a bunch. felt like a little comfortable about draft. We didn't really like come up with a team deck or anything. We're all kind of playing whatever we wanted. So I wasn't like super confident, but I was happy to be there, you know, kind of nervous. Roll up for the draft. Right before the draft, I get a phone call. And the phone call is that my grandmother is in the hospital and she has cancer and she's dying. I'm like, okay. That's really bad. That was like obviously a very stressful, difficult moment. Should I come home? And my dad was like, yes, but we don't know what's going on right now. Like, we'll try to like book a flight earlier, but don't skip your pro tour. I know how much this means to you. I'm like, oh, okay. What do I do now? So I owe to the draft. And obviously I'm like emotionally a complete mess at this point. I'm almost like, I'm sitting trying to eat lunch, almost crying. Like everything's just like falling down around me. This is my dream. My dream's being destroyed. My grandmother's dying. Oh my God. But I'm like, all right, you know what? I can't do anything about any of this. I OTU'd because I drafted poorly because I was upset, but like, I can't blame that. That's my own fault. I drafted poorly. I'm OTU. I'm going to make the best of this. I'm going to do everything I can. I like my standard deck. It's going to be great. So I win the next six rounds. There's something to be said for learning. There's something to be said about learning how to recover from tilt. And that was a good example for me of like just realizing that it's a game. And if you get too emotionally caught up in the game on top of any number of like real life pressures, you're just going to fall apart. Nothing's going to work. And so when you find yourself in those holes, you gotta just gather yourself, which get things together. I've had a bunch of other tournaments since then where I've lost round one, just been really upset, but been like, you know what, like, whatever, I'm just going to play. I'm in the 0-1 bracket. I can't lose. Like, give myself some stupid pep talk and just like just rattle off a bunch of wins in a row. But it's just very important to never let yourself get in a hole, no matter how bad things get in a Magic tournament. Because remember, it's a Magic tournament. It's not that important. It's a game. It's the greatest game in history, but it's a game.
You know, I really, like you said, there's something to be said about learning how to come back from tilt. I also really think, you know, that mindset really does play a lot. A couple months ago, we had this string of episodes where a lot of people were talking about how when they would approach a tournament, not that they didn't care, because obviously you wouldn't be at a competitive tournament playing, you know, paying what the entry fee to compete if you didn't care at all. But when they just kind of like release themselves from the pressure and the responsibility of doing well and just going to enjoy the tournament and, you know, doing their best no matter what, that they would just perform better, you know. And similar here, this story, I love the takeaway. You had a lot going on, obviously. And, you know, you're sitting there and thinking and realize, you know what, like, there are some things that are out of my control, but the things that are in my control, for example, you know, I drafted poorly. You could have very easily said, oh, I'm doing poorly because my grandma's not doing well. I'm really worried about her, which is true. Like, you have that emotional state going on, but you were able to say, you know what? Yes, that is a fact that's going on in my life right now. And I do have that, you know, emotional strain. However, that doesn't change the fact. And it's not an excuse that I drafted poorly and that's why I didn't do well. And then you were able to, you know, okay, let's make the best of this and move forward. And you did. So I think that is really, really neat, you know, seeing that mindset and, like you said, being able to come back and you know, you say, oh, it's a stupid little pep talk or whatever, but sometimes it's just a perspective change that is able to put you in the right mindset to move forward.
It's very important to never let yourself get into an emotional gutter if you are intending to win matches of Magic. If you go into a match with a defeatist attitude, like you're thinking, oh, this is a matchup I can't win, or oh, my opponent's so much better than me, you'll never win.
Right.
Like, obviously you can. It's a game with inherent variance, but like, you're putting yourself in such a massive hole that it's just not going to happen, no matter how well you think you're playing. Like, it just won't happen.
And then don't do the thing where like, oh, I've had a win streak, I'm bound for loss, right? I'm due to lose because of variance, whatever. You know, it resets every single game, you know, like, cause we always talk about this, you know, on losing streaks, you know, saying, all right, clear your mind. The match that you played before has no bearing on this match right now. Just, you know, do your best in this, keep your mind in this moment. And all that's true for both sides, whether you had, you just came off of five wins or whether you're on a run of three losses, like, every match is unique. You know, you're paired up with somebody in your bracket, and it doesn't matter how many wins you had before, you can win this one. It doesn't matter how many losses you had before, you can win this one. You know, you just got to move. You just got to keep that in mind.
The only bearing that the result of a previous game of Magic has on the variance coming up in an upcoming game of Magic is the way it affects you emotionally. So if you can get over yourself, there's no such thing as like a streak.
Yeah, so true. That's so true. If you can get over yourself, there's such a thing as a streak. You know, if you just, you know, work into your mindset, every time you're shuffling, you're like, all right, I'm resetting my variance. I'm, you know, you're just resetting it. You're clearing the board from last time. You're shuffling up a new game and you're just ready to go. So
on another point, there's also almost nothing you can do about variance. So thinking about it is a huge waste of time.
Right. So true. So true. Now, on the flip side are our highs and our proud magic moments. What has been your proudest magic moment to date?
Yeah, my favorite magic moment was probably actually, yeah, probably winning that WMCQ and getting to go to Worlds and representing my country there. That was like, we have a lot of just, for whatever reason, we have a lot of Canadian pride when it comes to Magic. And there's like a couple like weird in-country rivalries too, specifically when it comes to Toronto versus Montreal. Yeah, it's a very French versus Anglo thing.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Historically, where is face-to-face games?
Both in Toronto and Montreal.
Oh, okay.
The original store's in Montreal, and a couple of years ago, myself and some other guys here opened face-to-face Toronto.
Okay, so I didn't know if that was like part of, I don't know, like that was one coast and this was the other, or something. I didn't know. So
it's kind of east versus west, except we're 5 hours from each other.
Okay,
there you go. 30-minute flight away, because you know. Population density in Canada is a little weird. But anyways, we've had a history in Canada of the teams we send to Magic Worlds, World Magic Cup, or whatever, being oddly split among like geographical boundaries. There's almost always been like two guys from Ontario, one guy from like Vancouver or like Edmonton or one of the like somewhere no one cares about, you know, places that don't exist, like the prairies. It's like if someone from Idaho qualified, there's always like a guy from Idaho. And then there was always a random Frenchie. It's always a random French guy from Montreal or a suburb of Montreal on the team. And there's been so many like storied tales of the random Frenchies. Obviously sometimes they're like actually extremely good at Magic and we're just being like really rude to them because they're French, but no one likes the French, right? I'm French. I can say this.
Yeah. The last name of Fournier. So
yeah, I am French. None of this is racist. I think that's how that works. But there's always stories of like there being a random French guy who qualifies for the World Magic Cup or for Worlds through Nationals who only plays red, black zombies. They'll be preparing for the tournament for like a month beforehand or whatever, and they'll finally get a hold of their teammate and he'll be like, I only play red black zombies, I don't care what you're testing. Like, all right. Sweet, I'm glad that this matters so much to you. So when I got to go to Montreal, which is the French speaking part of Canada, and defeated my teammate and friend who drove me there in the finals in a mirror match with Nissa Worldwaker, the card I tried to convince him to play in his deck, but he refused to. It was just like this super high point of like, all right, everything's great. There's no random Frenchie on this team. But the team at that point was Pro Tour champion Sean McLaren, Pro Tour champion Alexander Hain, my friend from Toronto who won the Toronto event, David Goldfarb, and myself. I'm like, all right, this is probably the best non-Japanese team in the history of the World Magic Cup. We're going to win. Obviously, we're like 0-3 at the tournament, but that's not the point.
Oh.
I had this moment of like, oh, I get to scoreboard my friend forever. I'm on the best World Magic Cup team ever. I get to go play the World Magic Cup. I get to represent Canada. Like, this is the greatest of all time. And so I spent the car ride home just being very rude to Paul. It was great.
But that's neat that you're able to represent, you know, your country on, you know, the World Magic Cup, because that's obviously a, like, you know, like you alluded to, a very unique and awesome experience that not every Magic player gets to do. So that's really neat. I love that. That was your high.
Yeah, the GPN Pro Tour circuit is like extremely, extremely fun, extremely rewarding. It's the most prestigious and everything. But in a sense, I don't know, there's something about like Nationals and Worlds that like just gets me going. It's the national pride aspect. Like, I want to show, not only do I want to show that Canada's the best, but I want to show that Toronto's the best. All these regional rivalries that may or may not be real. I want to show that we're the best Canadians.
Now, at your, as of this recording, your most recent, you know, Grand Prix, making the top eight there, let's dive into your preparation for that event. What did it look like? How far out did you, you know, pick your deck? And then how much were you practicing? Like, what did that look like so that we can get a feel of what it takes to get there?
All right, don't do what I do in preparing for that tournament.
Oh, boy, off. Okay. Story.
We had tested for a number of weeks beforehand. We had, as of at the moment, the Team Lucas EOS basement that I've been talking about recently is not like as active as we used to be. Lucas is working on an MBA. Paul Dean, despite being a platinum pro, is like very busy with work, so he doesn't get to test very much. So mostly I'm playing with another group of friends, just a group of like real life friends. And we've randomly been like putting people onto the Pro Tour through the Toronto RPTQ every time. So I had one random friend by the name of Ryan Sandrin, who was qualified for Pro Tour, what was it, Aether Revolt? Yeah, Pro Tour Aether Revolt. The week before that, there's a Star City Games Open in Columbus that we were all planning on going to. And we knew that the week after the Pro Tour, there was a GP in Pittsburgh that we were all planning on going to. So for like 5 or 6 weeks or something, we were just actually playing a ton of Standard. It's like 2 or 3 nights a week, we'd get together at a store downtown in Toronto called 401 Games. And we would basically, some of us have and do work there. So we just would stay there like super late after hours, playing a million matches of Magic with all of the viable decks. Yeah. So our testing started like a week or two before SCG Columbus. We all rolled up to there with Jeskai Saheeli, just because we had thought that it was kind of the best week one deck. People either wouldn't be prepared for it or be overly prepared for it. And by overly prepared, I mean playing cards like Authority of the Consoles and Lost Legacy, which while they're effective answers to the Saheeli Rai Felidar Guardian combo, are objectively bad cards elsewhere. And that we would be able to effectively play around those through the Glimmer of Genius Trenchal Gearhold combo, blah, blah, blah. And we would be able to do well at that tournament. So a bunch of us played the deck. We did like fairly well on average, had a bunch of us cashed. I made it to the top 8 and lost my quarterfinals there. And then immediately after that tournament, we're like, all right, you know what? Jeskai Saheeli is definitely not good anymore. It's not good against the black-green decks that won the tournament. But we realized quickly that it was actually okay against black-green. It's actually very good against black-green if you built your deck well. We had played a bunch of like shocks in the main deck, and we had no idea that like we didn't play like Immolating Glares or Fumigates or whatever, which are all the cards that are actually good against black green. And then next weekend, I think it was Dylan Donegan at an SCG won that one with Jeskai Saheeli, basically taking my deck and cutting all the bad cards like shock for good cards like Immolating Glare, and he was just destroying black green. We're like, all right, sweet, Jeskai Saheeli is extremely good. So on Pro Tour weekend, we went and played a bunch of PPTQs. And we all played Jeskai Saheeli and all got trounced over and over again by like the Mardu decks that were super popular at the PT. Like, oh, Jesus Christ, like this is so standard. Every week a different deck dominates. It's this awful rock, paper, scissors. We're going to have to predict what's good next week, figure it out. So we had tried to come up with a deck before GP Pittsburgh that was good against all of these decks. It was good against black-green Winding Constructors, like aggressive black-green decks. Good against Mardu vehicles. And passable against Jeskai Saheeli. Because after the results of the Pro Tour, we thought that people would not try to bring Jeskai Saheeli to the table because, you know, it literally can't beat Mardu vehicles. It just can't. And we played a lot of Magic Online in the week leading up to Pittsburgh. I didn't, actually. I hate Magic Online, but my friends did. And we gathered together like 3 or 4 nights or something over the week and played a billion games. And most people decided to play black-green Delirium, like a big black-green deck with like Ishkanaha, maybe like Gaunti, Lord of Luxury, Mindrak. Is it Mindrak Demon? Yeah, I think it's called Mindrak Demon. Just like a big black-green deck. The idea was it was good. It was favored against the more aggressive black-green decks. It was also actually really good against Mardu. I didn't have access to a lot of the black-green cards because I've been testing Mardu in like 4-color Jeskai Saheeli and stuff over the course of the week. And I just didn't want to like go hunt down these cards the night before the tournament. So I'm like, all right, whatever. I'm going to play Mardu. Mardu's the best deck. It was like the top 6 decks at the Pro Tour. This Mardu Vehicles deck is so good. It's so good. It's so good. And then like Thursday night, it's like 2 a.m. We're playtesting and I lose something like 14 games in a row against Black Green. I'm like, and I know that this is wrong. And this is not how you're supposed to like interpret results. You're supposed to like look at variants and stuff, and like you're supposed to have like a mathematically quantifiable number of results to make decisions based on it. But that moment I was like, you know what, screw Mardu, there's no way this is good. I can't possibly do this. I don't have time to build black green. You know what, I'm gonna bring both Mardu and Jeskai with me to the event. And so that's like a very bad idea. Bring two decks with you to an event. Arrive on the deck that you want to play before the tournament, because your build's just going to be bad. If you're choosing the deck you're going to play the night before the tournament, you're not going to have a tuned deck. Having a tuned version of a deck is typically more important than having the deck. Having, like, let's say there's like three best decks or whatever, and one of them is like slightly better on that weekend than the other because of the texture of the metagame. You're better off having the third best deck built perfectly than the top deck built poorly. And also there's a level of like just being confident with whichever one you're playing. So on the card right there, I'm like furiously messaging people on Facebook about how upset and confused I am. And at some point, my friend Omar tells me, Modo is literally all black-green decks. Just play Jeskai. Jeskai's good this weekend. I'm like, all right. Like, there's literally no way that's true, but okay. So I hastily built Jeskai Saheeli, convinced two of my friends to play it, because, you know, got to take some people down with me, you know? If I'm going down, I don't want to be alone in my sadness. No, and then I played against black-green 12 times at the GP. And thanks to that statistic, Tommy did it. So my preparation was wasted, and I got really lucky. So for that tournament, don't prepare how I did.
Well, I mean, what I pull away is that just the whole process of going through, I mean, for weeks you were looking at the metagame and building decks and playing with friends and going to events and looking at the metagame. And so even though the day before you're still kind of lost and confused, I think the process was good in that you were actively involved in researching what was going on. And you were, it's not like you didn't do any research and then the day before you're like, oh, I don't know this deck or that deck. You know, you were in the process kind of going through it. And obviously it's relatively fresh standard, and so there's still that rock paper scissors going on, people figuring stuff out, and so you were kind of caught up in that. But I still think the process is very beneficial and others can learn from that, which is several weeks out, be involved in researching and going to events and what's good, and you know, figure out what that rock paper scissor is, and then, you know, use all your tools, online, friends, your own play test sessions, to decide what you want to take to an event. So yeah, so you got lucky, but I think you went through a very valuable process as well.
Yeah, in my defense, playing against black-green 11 times over the course of Swiss was probably only like 3 times more than the mean. Like, that tournament, especially like late in day 2, every table around me was like black-green mirrors. And then there's like 1 4-color Jeskai, sorry, like 1 4-color Saheeli deck and like 1 Mardu deck. Like, it turned out that my metagame choice was like oddly spot on, but I was a little lucky.
No guest of the show has ever claimed otherwise. Like, a lot of them say, hey, you know, there's a, you do your part, but then there is an element of luck that gets you into a top 8. You know, you prepare, you go to events, you be consistent, you know, you go to many events because, you know, your time will come more or less. But everyone recognizes that there is, some weeks you pick the right deck and, you know, other weeks you do all the preparation and pick the wrong deck. And that's just how it goes.
You do have to be lucky to win a tournament. It's as simple as that. Like, LSV's luck plus skill equals victory thing. I was like, just literally 100% of it. Like, and it is important to not get hung up over the luck aspect of it. Like, you have to accept that sometimes, no matter what amount of preparation you put into it, no matter how well you played, you just can't win. That said, also, don't blame that for poor preparation or poor gameplay. If you played bad or prepared bad, you know, poorly, whatever, English is hard, don't then be like, oh, I got unlucky. Never blame getting unlucky for things. Like, I spent years complaining on the internet about every time I got unlucky, and getting like infinite hate points from everybody I knew. And only kind of recently have come to realize, like, oh my god, it literally doesn't matter if you got unlucky. Don't mention it. Don't talk about it. Like, no one cares. Like, just learn what you can from your loss or from your win or whatever, and like move on. Don't dwell on the variance of it. It's meaningless. Variance is meaningless. It's literally the most meaningful, but it's also meaningless.
So as you have played, you know, thousands of games and just observed so much, what is the biggest mistake that you see players make?
It's probably not the biggest mistake, but something specific that I notice a lot is people not paying attention to their technical play. Little things like how you tap your mana for things, being focused on, I don't know, like remembering triggers, being focused on playing your cards in correct order so as not to give away additional information. These are kind of little things that are a big differentiator between people who play a lot and win a reasonable amount, and people who play a lot and win like 5% more. Like, tapping your mana correctly in, let's say, Modern, where there's cards like Tectonic Edge that are legal. Tectonic Edge is like a land that says like you can sacrifice it to destroy a non-basic land if they have four or more lands in play. And in formats where like cards like Tectonic Edge are legal, you're supposed to like actually tap your non-basic lands first for to like leave up basic lands to like represent counter spells that you might have. And little things like that are things that like players who are like on the cusp of being competitive or like are new to playing competitively are things that people never think about. And it actually pays a lot in dividends over the course of like a Magic career to learn your technical play properly, to like do things like that properly without ever having to think about them. It's tough because you have to think about it every time you, it's a bunch of like very minor things that you have to think about every time you do them. But over time it becomes second nature and it becomes like a solid, like, +5% to your win rate. Like, it's very helpful to actually learn how to play technically properly.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So focusing on, you know, your technical play and not making those mistakes, card sequencing, tapping correctly, like, that's a really, really good point. Yeah, the technical play is something that, you know, it's one of the easier things to focus on, but harder things to master, you know? So
yeah, it's easy to focus on, but also remember, like, if you're not confident in your technical play, also don't spend all of your time thinking about it. If you're playing like an important tournament to you and you're not confident in your technical play, don't like take this and think, spend like 45 seconds on your upkeep thinking about like, oh, which lands do I tap to pay for this Pact of Negation? Like, just do it. Like, yeah, spend FNM working on your technical play. Don't spend the RPTQ working on your technical play.
That's good. That's good. Now, what have you learned from Magic that you've been able to apply to other areas of your life?
Nothing. The rest of my life is a dumpster fire. No, I'm kidding.
Next question.
I'm kidding. Magic and kind of like gaming in general has helped me be like very analytical about problems and like situations regarding to work. I used to play StarCraft Brood War very competitively before getting like significantly into Magic, and used to play StarCraft 2 and stuff as well. So a lot of these are like, there's actually a lot of odd similarities between the two games because there are a lot of, they both share the framework of the game being like a puzzle that has a solution that's impossible to play perfectly. The difference with StarCraft is that it goes at a million miles an hour and your mechanical skill matters a ton, whereas in Magic it's largely irrelevant. But having quick like visual analytical skills has helped a lot in a lot of weird things.
Like that, the quick visual analytical skills, being able to look at something, so you take in that visual input, and then being able to analyze and make a decision off of it. So
yeah, like it's made me really good at Sudoku, which obviously is irrelevant, but like there are a lot of things in terms of work and life that are basically games. You can, and by games I mean like a puzzle game. You can narrow down a lot of things to a puzzle, like in terms of like, I don't know, tech support, like the internet goes out, or you're a tournament organizer at a card shop and you open Wizards Event Reporter and it doesn't work, which is most of the time. And they're like, oh, how do I fix this? And being a gamer, being somebody who has played a lot of games, helps you in developing like analytical responses to problems.
Very cool. I like that. I like that a lot. That's awesome. And now,
great for math too. Great for math.
So turning the lens inward on you, what is the deepest thing you've learned about yourself from playing Magic?
That's a harder question. I think Magic has helped me a lot in terms of realizing my talents, I guess. Like when I was, how to explain this? Magic has helped me realize that I am good at like quick visual analysis of things and understanding like pattern recognition and games and yeah, that kind of stuff, which is something I'd like. I went to like a kind of fancy private school and like did well in it and, you know, school stuff, and then immediately went off to university and realized I didn't really know what I wanted to do in life at all. And so I ended up just playing like a lot of StarCraft and Magic and not paying much attention to school. You know, being liberated into the world and all you want to do is play games can be very difficult. But being in Magic and being involved with the game and being involved with the Magic community, which is on average a group of people who are more Sounds a little elitist, but more intelligent and more successful on average than people as a whole, given that the game requires a lot of skill and intelligence to play well, has taught me a lot about like kind of alternative paths to success, if that makes sense. There's a lot of people in this community who are successful in life and in their own emotional world without doing things the normal way, if that makes sense. I have a bunch of friends who are very good Magic players who never took the game like too super seriously, like had some good GP results or whatever. And then like we're like, all right, I'm going to start playing daily fantasy sports. And then like I've made like countless thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars through playing like daily fantasy and stuff like that, like DraftKings and all that stuff. Not to recommend that's for everybody. That's a great way to lose a lot of money. It's literal gambling if you don't know what you're doing. And then on the other hand, I have friends who, like Lucas, who are like very successful analytical minds and like took that to like work at banks. He's working on an MBA now. But like the skills that you learn through Magic have odd applications in life. And Magic has kind of taught me that despite the fact that I didn't just like complete my university education on my first try, I still don't really know what I want to do. I know that I'm developing a skill set that whenever I do get things together will be useful. And that's like been a huge boost to me. It's also like my social life. So
that is really awesome. Now, moving forward, what events will we see you at?
My current plans basically involve going to GP New Jersey sometime in March, which I believe is slightly before this episode is airing. So there's that. I'll be at the Pro Tour in Nashville. So that's the one I qualified for off of the Pittsburgh, wherever that was. That's exciting. Glad to finally play on the PT again. I'm also randomly qualified for the next SCG Invitational, so I don't remember when that is, but I'll be at that too. That's about it. I'll try to hit up some more GPs, but I don't think there's anything particularly nearby. It's difficult traveling to GPs from Toronto because everything's just like 9 hours away or more. Can't drive all these. It's crazy.
Good luck. We love wishing past guests good luck and watching them do great things. So we can't wait to see how you do this year. That'd be awesome.
I'll try my best. My goal is to hit silver. So
Yes. How many points do you have now?
4.
And then 3 of the PT, so 7. So yeah, put up a couple more good results at Grand Prix or 2 and you're good to go.
Yeah, I think if I can qualify for Kyoto, I'm good. That's my goal. So I'm going to try to do that.
Prodigies, quick reminder, if you want to connect with Daniel, you can do so on Twitter at Trentu. So just look him up there, say thanks for being on the show, and ask him a question, what have you. And Daniel, as we wrap things up, what is one last parting piece of guidance? Either something you've already said that you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end.
When playing standard, stop switching decks. Just don't. Pick your deck. Play it. That's it.
Well, Daniel, I want to acknowledge you and thank you so much for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you for sharing your time and your experiences with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
Thank you. Thank you.
Daniel, thank you so much. That was awesome. Loved having you on the show. Learned a lot. Prodigies, I know you did too. Isn't he awesome? As always, you can find the show notes at mtgpro2.com/Daniel Fournier. That's Fournier. Daniel Fournier. What a fun name. Anyways, there you'll find a synopsis of everything that we talked about, as well as links to any resources that were mentioned. And of course, you can join the MTG Pro Tutor Facebook group. And there you'll find a synopsis of everything that we talked about, as well as links to any resources that were mentioned. And to close things out, two quick reminders for you. One, I was a guest on the Kitchen Table Magic podcast with Sam Tang. That was awesome. That episode should be out today. So look up the Kitchen Table Magic podcast and you'll find my interview there. It was a lot of fun. Thank you, Sam. I love being a guest. That was awesome. Two, the Deck Building Masterclass comes out this Friday. So go to deckbuildingmasterclass.com where you can sign up for the waiting list there and be notified the instant that the Deck Building Masterclass is available. Last week, I recorded sessions with AJ Soccer, Michael Majors, and Matt Severa. Coming out to about 4 hours worth of content where we just dove into standard, evaluating the meta, tracking shifts in the game, talking about how to build a deck, how to tweak a deck, what are some of the considerations you need when you do that, sideboarding decisions, all that good stuff. And all that comes out this Friday. There will be a PDF download for everybody to where you get the top level strategy, the really actionable stuff that you need to put into practice. And then there'll be the option for anybody who wants to dive into those videos and really get a lot out of these great pros and the tips that they have to share, the knowledge that they impart. It's going to be fantastic. So deckbuildingmasterclass.com is where you can go for that. And then one more thank you in this episode for the patrons. Love you guys. Thank you so much for the support. I really, really, really appreciate it. I love doing the giveaway each and every month. And if you are interested in joining that giveaway and being a supporter of the show, you can go to mtgpro2.com/Patreon to learn more about that. With that said, thank you so much for joining me today. We have a lot of cool stuff coming up. Next of which is this Friday, we have another episode and the Deck Building Masterclass goes live. So that should be a lot of fun. Until then, take care. I am Sean of The Gathering and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.